Formula Access, I got a special one for you. Straight from my heart of marketing, today I bring you Stefan Bridges of Red Bull Racing. Stefan has had an illustrious career in motorsports. He is a creative. He is the head of creative and design for Red Bull Racing, and he is the gentleman that designs the suits, the livery, the helmets, the cold air guns that go into the intakes. He does all of the racing garages for the team. He has worked for Ron Dennis at McLaren. You guys, we get into all of this stuff. We talk about the culture of McLaren versus Red Bull. We talk about just working for Ron Dennis and, you know, what it's like to work for leaders that demand the most out of their people and extract the best and brightest that people and personnel have to offer, and just the cultural difference of a maverick independent like Red Bull and what that experience was like. You guys, Stefan was awesome. Please pardon, we had actually had a power outage in the house during the recording, and it's taken me almost 4 weeks to fix the recording and the audio and the visual and whatnot. So about halfway through, pardon all of my lights going out, the televisions in the background going out. We did keep the Wi-Fi connection going, but just pardon the visuals and enjoy the conversation, you guys. Stefan is a treat. Formula Access, we bring the people of motorsports to your doorstep. Again, I strive to find new titles, new people, people from all over motorsports. And today we have another high-level guest. I met this guest on LinkedIn. I sent a message to this guest. He responded back rather quickly. We jumped on a really quick intro call that lasted 30 minutes. I knew immediately I should have just started recording that call. Today, we've got a really special guest, Stefan Bridges of Red Bull Racing. Stefan, thank you for coming on.
Hi, good to be here. No problem at all.
I get really excited when we have guests like you. And every time I reach out to somebody that's not the team principal or a driver, they respond back, why would anybody want to hear my story? why does anyone care? And I can tell you, everyone cares very much. And, you know, the more out of Drive to Survive the title is, the better viewership and engagement that I get from it. And actually, I just secured a model maker as a guest, and you have no idea how hard I have tried to get this person on there, because everyone responds back, nobody cares what I do. And you have no idea how many requests I get for that type of title. So anyway, it's a long-winded answer. Stefan, seriously, thank you for coming on and just kind of sharing what you do and your story within arguably one of the greatest teams in Formula One.
I hope so. Yeah, I think so. I think so. It's not always been so, but it certainly has been for a little while now. Yeah.
I'm an entrepreneur. So like when I see somebody do something that hasn't really historically been normal, I get excited about it. You guys came in as a sponsor, became an independent, and now you're like a full-fledged constructor, but all founded upon an entrepreneurial endeavor. And I personally am always amazed at companies that can maintain that identity as they grow. And, you know, Red Bull has never lost that identity from, you know, from the acquisition of Jaguar to today. Like, you still are that, like, I don't know, you know, I've heard Christian say, like, the maverick of Formula One. And I appreciate that. I like competition, but I also like, I like the underdog story. Ah, an independent, you'll never, you know, you'll never win four titles in a row and then another two.
If I was allowed to use a Star Wars analogy, I always like to see it as the Rebel Alliance against the Galactic Empire, the forces of the established old school. You know, we're the rebels, but hopefully we have equally good equipment as the Empire.
Equally, I don't know.
that's the dream. Rebel Alliance.
So obviously everyone knows who Red Bull is. Let tell the audience who you are and kind of what your role is within Red Bull.
Okay, well, I'm head of creative design at Red Bull Racing. It's a job that right now, at the moment, concentrates mainly on how the team looks in 3D. Throughout my time at the team, because I've been with the team for 17 years, since 2006, it's encompassed a whole wide range of things, mainly 3D, realized projects, but also there's been graphics, brand identity, all that kind of stuff over the years. So that can encompass a huge array of stuff at the factory, with our campus. It can incorporate a lot of things that you see at the track, in the paddock, down at driver suits, all kinds of things. It's the, you know, it's a creative way of realizing what would Red Bull look like if they had a Formula One team. You know, that's what we're constantly, you know, that's what we're constantly striving for. That's what we're looking to encapsulate. What does Red Bull look like as a Formula One team? And that's my job, with a small team as well, to kind of look after that and guide that, set the visual tone. So that's really what I do. And there's lots of layers to it.
I mean, I know the answer to this, but for the audience, like, big picture, how important is that role in Formula One?
Well, it is, like I touched on, it has everything that you do has to say Red Bull Racing. Obviously, Red Bull as a brand, it's very playful, it's energetic, it's fun, it doesn't do things the way that other people would do them. But at the same time, in Formula One, it's a sport of technical excellence. You know, it's about lap time. It's got to be practical as well as looking cool. So really, you know, it touches on so many things. The race garage, everybody's race garage is different. Everybody has different needs. Everybody has the same kind of footprint to work within. But apart from that, you can do whatever you want. Each team has different requirements. The pit wall that the guys will sit on, that Christian sits on, with the team manager and the strategists, everyone's a different size. Some people have 4 seats, we have 7, some people have 8. Everybody has different requirements. And really, we have one very important client, which is Red Bull Racing, and everything we do is tailored for them. Everything has to work for them as a brand and practically as well. So that's, you know, it's a very wide ranging, I think it's a very important thing. It's a kind of the intersection of art and technology, really. You've got the pure technology, which is the engineering, which is the machining, which is the aero, and you've got the art factor of it. You know, it's, you could send out a carbon fiber car with number on it, as that, you know, that obeys the letter of the law with the regulations. Everything else on it is decorative, and that's to get over a brand, it's to get over partners. You know, it's all of the icing on the cake as well.
So it would be safe to say that you're responsible for everything visually within the team. I mean, that's helmets, suits, garages, livery.
Yeah. I've worked on all of those things. Like I said, right now at the moment, there are so many 3D projects that are ongoing that I've kind of specialized a little bit more in that, because that's my background. That's where I came from. And there is a team of very able graphic designers as well and brand designers who work with me, and between us, you know, we're covering all of these strands, whether it's in a print, whether it's paint, right through to realized three-dimensional objects, which is mainly what I look after now.
So three-dimensional would be the garage.
It is, yeah. It's, you know, it's tangible things. If graphics is a print, or it's something digital on the screen, three-dimensional means that we have, you know, we've made a physical object. A lot of what you see, certainly with our team, is designed, engineered, and built in-house. So all of the garage, we have the frame is made by an external company to our specifications. We have people who make panels and lighting for us, but it's all directed and assembled and finished at the factory. The pit wall as well is a completely bespoke item. The stools that the guys sit on are completely bespoke as well.
So my initial intention of reaching out to you goes back to 2020, was it? On an episode of Drive to Survive, like if you don't watch Drive to Survive, it's really hard to capture this stuff. That's what I actually like about the show. During the transition from Gasly to Albon over the summer break, Netflix did an incredible job, or Box to Box, whoever actually produces that, did an incredible job of showcasing obviously a horrendous situation for some people that worked out in the end, but all of the things that had to take place over the summer break. So for you guys, it's what, 3 weeks that you had to virtually change?
Yeah, 2 weeks shut down.
So you had to change headshots, driver numbers, driver images, branding, everything, like boxes, crates.
Yes, everything, yeah, in a very short amount of time. You basically got a microcosm of what an average winter looks like, but compressed from maybe 6 to 8 weeks into two.
And you don't have to get too deep into this, but like when the team comes and they say, okay, I know it's summer break, but we're going to swap our drivers here. Like, do you guys panic? I mean, does this feel like an enormous project? Cause it seems as a fan, it always just like, okay, well, you just do a seat fitting, take one out, put one in, and you know, go.
There is an element of that. There is an element of that. But at the same time, the Formula One mentality is that we don't have any choice. It's got to be done. And nobody else can do it. And if anybody can do it, we can. And we will. Probably the scariest moment is figuring out how you're going to tell your wife that you've got to work over the shutdown. That's probably the scariest element of it, because they put up with a lot. They do put up with a lot. And it's just a question of you've just got to get it done. You find a way, because we always somehow find a way. You can have, you know, last year's car build leading up to the RB18 was probably from, you know, a near outsider's perspective, watching what was going on and talking to the guys in production, talking to the guys in car build, was probably the most nightmarish, awful winter in terms of timescales that we've ever had. Certainly one of the worst I've ever experienced. And look what resulted from it. You know, a car that ended up being dominant over the course of the season and pretty much rinsed everybody else in the second half of the year. So out of enormous adversity and challenges came something amazing, our most successful car ever.
So
it's just that mindset. Everybody just gets on with it.
That kind of culture, mindset, or personality exists even in marketing, creative, and on the branding side of Formula One. The same thing that you see, you know, with I guess the engineering team or the track side team, you have that same just raw passion for competition and winning. Everybody just goes all out, no matter where you are inside of the team.
Absolutely. You know, it's not to say that there aren't sometimes arguments and people butt heads over things. Happens all the time. But, you know, that's human nature. At the end of the day, though, somehow the big drum at the back of the boat is hit and everybody rows in unison and everybody goes in the same direction. And it all ends up working beautifully. And I think that's been one of the strengths of the team, is that the right people have been put in the right jobs and allowed to do what they do best. You know, particularly I could, you know, Adrian's a shining example of that, having come from McLaren at pretty much the same time as he did and starting at Red Bull at a similar time, allowing the right people to work in the right environments and building the right teams around them can, you know, can yield incredible results.
I think it's also a testament to recruiting and HR. You know, we have a family marketing agency, so I'm around creatives all the time. You know, I'm around designers. I'm around that, you know, in my company, you know, we have an entire marketing team. And so, you know, that high-paced, high-performing, like, passion and a creative is a hard-to-find combination. You know, it's a testament to recruiting to be able to find somebody, you know, that can work through summer break, have a conversation with their wife and say, hey, not sure if we can go on vacation, you know, this year.
Yeah.
I've got to do a driver change. The wife's like, wait, what?
Yeah. And I think if you ask the same question of anybody in any F1 team, they'd give you a similar kind of answer, you know, whether you're at the front of the grid or the back of the grid. Everybody has a similar kind of mindset once you open that door and get into each team.
I've never run across anyone on this show. I think we're probably 40 guests, if I remember correctly, which is nothing in comparison to the sport itself. But I've never run into somebody that is inside of motorsport for a paycheck. Nobody is there because it was the only one that would hire them. It is just this gnawing passion inside of them to just win and produce at the highest levels. You guys are all, I tell people inside my company all the time, you know, and I just say, like, it's really cool to talk to people that, you know, over and over and over and over, these high performing, go getter, type A, get it done no matter what. Like, there is no, there is no I can't. It's, I'll find a way. It might take me a minute, you know, might take twice the amount of people to do it, but I get it done. Is really encouraging to me and also helps me identify talented people really quick, because it's like, well, I talk to them all the time. Not in the same industry, not in the same profession, but, you know, I know what that looks like, and it's getting quicker and quicker.
Yeah.
But going back to your role, I mean, we know what it looks like when you make a driver change and everybody has to cancel stuff, but what does that look like from season to season? I mean, you're in that element today, but what does 2020 to 2021 or 2021 to 2022 look like for your role?
Really, that there are certain sets of things that remain the same, you know, in terms of what needs to be done every year. So the livery gets revised. If we have a new partner come on board, for instance, with pit crew helmets, then you start a process again where you have to size everybody up. You have to order the right product in. You have to make sure it's tested and it works for the pit stops. You have to make sure that they're all branded correctly, work with the external partners to get them painted, liveried, and all delivered on time and issued to the guys. You might have a big project. For instance, this year, for me, the overriding thing this winter has been that we are upgrading all of the race garages. We have five currently that wing their way around the world and leapfrog from circuit to circuit. We're actually upgrading all five of those, and we're building a whole new sixth set as well that will, ease the burden a little bit for the huge calendar, because they're always adding more and more races, so it gets logistically harder and harder. So that's the whole process of I've designed that, then I've worked with engineering, and then we work with suppliers to get the whole thing drawn, built, costed, and all ready in the freight to get out. So the first one left around Christmas time. The second one left for Australia at the beginning of January. We've got a third one that's leaving imminently. So effectively, what seems to happen is that the period between the end of the last season ending and the start of next season seems to get smaller and smaller every year. It goes from like months to weeks. So it's like a never-ending cycle. We're about to embark on the driver photo shoots for this year as well. There's a couple of them. There's one happening next week for drivers and partners, and then there's another one that's happening after that. We've got a pre-season shakedown where we're going to do a dry run with the garage and with the new RB19. So there's a huge amount of elements that have to be looked at every year. And of course, nothing stands still. The team kit, we've got a new team kit partner this year as well. So this new kit that's been designed over the course of last year, driver suits changing, new design for those as well. It comes down to graphics on the screens. Although we have a fairly fixed color palette, we have a brand identity that's ours. We have certain colors that are ours: dark blue, fluoro red, fluoro yellow. Within that, there can be a whole number of permutations, new designs that all fit within that sphere, but all get refreshed and upgraded for the season ahead. And pretty much every team does that. So.
Stefan, what's the craziest, I don't know, the craziest item that you guys have to brand? It didn't even cross my mind that like the tire guns are probably branded too. Like what would fans be like surprised that you have to brand and prepare and
If you may spot them when they bring the cars into the garage, but we have these very long-nosed air blowers that I believe Honda supply, and they're kind of like your average garden leaf blower, except these ones are modified for really high pressure, and they're directing them into the air intakes and the brake ducts to keep everything cool. We brand those up. If you look closely, they've got team logos and bulls on them. I think they might actually be individually numbered for each driver car as well. A 1 in 11 drinks bottles. Everything gets examined and looked at.
That's so crazy. And you have to procure all of that, design it, and I imagine, when you think of the air blower, are you guys vinyl wrapping that, or are you like, are those parts manufactured with your branding around it?
Generally, if they're people that we work closely with, we will provide them with a paint specification, and it should come in ready painted. And then we produce the graphics with a graphics house who we're kind of very tightly embedded with. They have an office on site as well, and they'll produce all of those to our specification, apply them, and then deliver them to the race team to go to all the races.
Like the logistics in me is going crazy thinking of all of these items that you have to design, brand, make sure they show up in time. Because as you said, you're already shipping parts to races and it's, end of January. I would be in a constant state of panic if I was in your shoes, just going, wow, I hope I hope, the branding is correct. It's the right shade. I've done stuff like that in the past and, you get a good
There's
sense of your
always, yeah. There's always some things that slip through the net. Historically, I can remember a filming day happening, and the car went out and it had only done a it had done a few laps, and they'd been filming it all. There were helicopters involved, and then somebody noticed that their rather important logo was missing off of what we call the trade area, which is the low down on the side near where the exhausts used to come out. And so it was like walkie-talkies, stop the shoot, stop the shoot. There's a logo missing. So to bring the car back into the garage, the logo had to go on. All the filming had to be scrapped. And
You print that stuff out on site?
I mean, the graphics were lurking somewhere in a drawer in the spares container out the back. Presumably, they might have done an engine cover change, or there are many different bodywork variations that they might try, and presumably they'd put one on and it was not fully branded, and they just sent the car out and no one had done a final check on it. I mean, it does happen.
It does.
Luckily, I wasn't the one responsible for carrying the can that day, so.
I mean, this is may tell me if I'm overstepping my line, but does the team come together in a situation like that and solve problems, or is it immediately like, who forgot to do that or whatever? Or is it like we get a laugh out of it, we solve the problem, and we move on?
Yeah, there'll be a bit of that goes on. You know, there's the level of the level of humor is nothing if not dry. You know, somebody will get they'll get pelted with rotten fruit for a couple of hours and made to feel like a fool. But then it will kind of people move on.
You guys create company memes and send them around and give people trouble
Oh
for
yeah,
that.
yeah, it, yeah, it, yeah, it happens. Yeah.
So going back, I mean, have you been a motorsports fan since a kid? I mean, is this something you've wanted to do for forever, or did you like, how did this journey begin?
Yeah, strangely, no. I mean, I wasn't really brought up in a motorsport-centric family. I mean, the F1 would be on TV at the weekends. I can remember watching the races with Murray Walker and James Hunt commentating back in the 80s and the 90s. It was something that was there. I never had any particular burning ambition to work in motorsport or F1. I wanted to be a car designer. That's what I grew up wanting to do, and that's what I went to university and did a degree and studied in. And I did it for about a year after graduation as a consultant contractor. And F1 didn't arrive on the scene for me until 2001, after I'd done a couple of jobs following uni. And I simply applied for a job that was advertised in a publication called Design Week. Back in the days of print media, it would all go around to all the design studios. The place I was working in London, it came in, and McLaren were advertising for product designers. It was simply a job ad in the back. I was getting a little bit disillusioned of living in London. The hours were long. The pay wasn't particularly good. It was a fantastic job with fantastic people. I learned a lot and I worked on some really cool stuff, but I was ready for a change. I was ready to get out of London, and ready to take the next step. So I applied for the job. They set a project, which I can remember doing late at night in the studio, the place that I was working at. Fortunately, late nights are pretty common there, so nobody really noticed anything different. And went along to Woking and was interviewed twice with the project that they'd set. I think it was something like a future pit crew helmet with liquid cooling to keep the guys' heads cool. They must have liked what I did because they offered me a job. And I
You
started there in September of 2001.
are the only guest that I've ever had on the show that has been hired by McLaren. I would say almost every guest that I've had on the show has applied in one way or another, including Lando Norris's dad. Oddly enough, that's where his son drives. But he graduated school and applied, and they didn't want him, and little did they
Yeah.
know they'd have to hire his son decades later. But
I mean, I know a lot about what they were doing in retrospect, but at the time it seemed like a slightly unusual move because you'd see Formula One on TV and you'd see a lot of high-level engineering, you'd see a lot of graphics, but in terms of people doing things which are fairly commonplace now, the kind of stuff that I work on, it wasn't really happening back in the early 2000s. And I think McLaren were quite pioneering. I think Ron Dennis, who was the team principal at the time, he had this kind of vision of where this stuff might go. He was always very aesthetically aware. He always had extremely high standards of presentation and how a brand and a team should look. And I think they were quite pioneering in hiring us because I was one of three people that they hired at that time. I had the most work experience of the three. And I think they were generally trying to do something a bit different there. And
How was
quite a lot of the stuff I worked
it?
on is still, it's, if you go to the MTC, the Technology Center, it's still there.
How was it working for him? I mean, that's obviously working for a design firm, then going to Formula One, and not only Formula One, but under probably one of the best leaders, I would say, in Formula One history. Not everybody might like him, but I'd probably say he's a pretty results-driven guy.
Yeah, Ron was actually absolutely nothing to do with the interview process at all. We didn't meet him until we went out to Monza in the September of the 2001 season. And I can remember the three of us all kind of nervously sitting outside the motorhome, outside this door, waiting for this guy to appear. And the first thing, he comes out and comes to sit down, and instantly all the cameras start flashing because we've been sitting there, three nondescript lads. And then all of a sudden, Ron Dennis comes out, and the media are all of a sudden interested. So you find yourself peering down the end of all these camera lenses, which was a bit disconcerting. I've only ever got good things to say about Ron. He could be a very difficult boss, very demanding, but if you could please Ron and know that you'd done a good job and he was pleased with what you'd done as well, there are a few things that are as satisfying as that I've ever experienced in my career. Because I was already aware of who he was from growing up watching F1 on TV, seeing him on TV, thinking, this guy's he's a little bit intimidating, the way he kind of stares down the camera. He's not a guy to be trifled with. He's clearly a guy who knows his own mind. He's clearly a guy who has a very strong vision and leadership and direction for his team. So actually, being in an environment where I was working for him and being set briefs and, had to come up with stuff that he liked was extremely satisfying because we forged a pretty good working relationship over the time that I was there. And he did try and persuade me very strongly not to leave and go to Red Bull. Put it that way. They weren't too delighted that I was off.
In a previous role, worked for a guy a lot like Ron, and very much the same as you. Obviously, I was in a sales role, not really a creative role, and I'd always remember, oh, if I can be the number one salesperson in the company, he's going to give me an attaboy or whatever. I go close this big contract. And he's going to be like, good job, take the day off, or hey, congratulations. And it never was like, it was always like, okay, cool. When are you going to close the next one? Or, he's just never satisfied. And he sent three emails in the 10 years that I worked for him that were congratulatory or in his own language, good job. I still have those. I've been gone from that company for 6 years now. I still have those emails. So I know what you're talking about. I think that pressure kind of can either send you spiraling downward or can take you further than you ever thought you could go. And I would imagine you could do that. Cause he was very upset when I resigned from the company as well. And he tried to deter me from it, but I told him, I said, I don't ever want to live in regret. I never want to look back and say, I didn't seize an opportunity and I have to do this. And he was like, okay.
Yeah, I had very specific reasons for wanting to leave at that time. And I think that they still hold true now with working at Red Bull, in that McLaren is, I'd always say it's, I worked a lot on that technology center over the course of about 18 months. At certain times, it felt like I lived in a hard hat and high-vis vest up on site while that thing was being built, working with Foster and Partners, the architects, on a lot of different features. But it's very much a kind of a three-dimensional representation of Ron's brain. It's very mathematical. Everything's perfect. It's all linear. Everything's considered. It's a great edifice. It's a great thing to admire. It's a great thing to look at. It's a great thing to visit. I didn't find it was a great place to work in. You know, for me personally, it wasn't a particularly creative environment for the kind of stuff that I wanted to do. And the room that we were in as well didn't have any windows because there was a lot of secret stuff going in. They were very paranoid, very secretive. So you had access control doors everywhere with kind of smoked glass that you couldn't see through. And Red Bull, by contrast, huge windows right the way along the front of the building, music on. 50% of the people in the office were jabbering away in German. There was Red Bull on tap. There were fridges full of all the flavors. And like, can I get a Red Bull? Anytime you want. You know, I don't advise 10 in a day. I think that was my maximum fairly early on. I don't advise that. But it just felt instantly a place where, you know.
Actually, I wanted to interrupt you real quick. Was that like, you just described something I think people overlook when, was that like going from, I don't know, working for IBM to like the early days of Google, the early days of Twitter, like the tech startup where, you know, culture mattered, collaboration mattered, innovation mattered. And, you know, it was work hard, play hard in the culture. It sounds to me like different cultures, same objective.
I mean, there were so many things that were different about Red Bull coming from McLaren. I mean, one of the things that struck me the most was it really felt like I dropped a formula. Having come from working in the MTC, our campus is very different now, 17 years on, but back in 2006, walking around there, it literally, you think, yeah, I can't believe these guys are in the same sport. There were things that looked similar, but the condition of the facility, you'd walk around some corners, you're like, I don't want to go down there. It was, you know, the culturally it was up here, but in terms of facilities, it was down here. That was the difference. But it was one of those things. It was what I needed at the time, and coming from McLaren to Red Bull was a very good schooling because they needed people like me. You know, they had a lot of mavericks, a lot of people with crazy ideas, but they weren't necessarily equipped to deal with actually realizing those ideas and making those things happen, because they were definitely a kind of a midfield team, a low midfield team. They had a reputation as being hard partiers. They'd pick up the odd point here and there, but they weren't serious contenders. I think, you know, I'd mark the difference between the two teams is during my time at McLaren, it felt like an established elite team who were underperforming because we didn't win a championship whilst I was there. Kimi nearly won it, but we would forever be blighted by car failures. Things would go wrong with the car. The engine was a particular point of contention as well with the Mercedes engine that they had at the time. Whereas Red Bull have gone on to be the great underachievers to begin with. And now, you know, we're, you know, scraping the sky on a regular basis. I don't think we've been out of the top three, you know, for like the past 10 years. It doesn't feel like it. So that was
is it the
marked difference between the teams. And Yeah, but I think you look at McLaren's facility and you think they've got all this, and yet there's something missing, that it's not coming together on like the design and the engineering front, or the way that the teams run. And I still think even to this day there are some elements of McLaren that would be better than Red Bull's facilities. But we have won the fastest pit stop for the fifth year in a row. You know, you don't necessarily need to work in the Death Star to have that kind of performance. You know, some of the facility, it doesn't have to look like the Starship Enterprise, but you can still win championships, and you can still set the fastest pit stops, and you can still look the best, and you can still be these mavericks who are winning. I think that's an interesting point that I still think now, and something is still not quite gelling with McLaren clearly.
Were you more empowered at Red Bull? So going from the Death Star to the Rebel Alliance, were you more empowered to, you know, get creative, think outside of the box, make decisions?
You were, but you know, with brutal honesty, I made some mistakes early on at Red Bull with some things I don't think I would ever get away with now. I think the culture of the team and excellence and, you know, operating at the highest level has become ingrained and accepted now. If you go back to 2006, 2007, maybe 2008, it wasn't so much then. They were still finding their way as a team. We hadn't started to win yet. And, you know, without highlighting any particular things, I did make a couple of foul-ups. And one of the things that Ron had said to me before I left McLaren was that, he said, they'll give you enough rope to hang yourself there. Because I think his impression was that McLaren was this huge, multi-layered, huge strength in depth team. And you and I was kind of a little bit cosseted within that environment. And, you know, operating within your comfort zone, you would always be very good at doing stuff for McLaren and it'd always go well. Whereas going outside of your comfort zone and not having that support at Red Bull, I think, yes, the mistakes could be greater, but I think subsequently the successes can be all the more sweeter and higher level as well. And I found that to be true. I bought a whole, I wouldn't deny, you know, you can't photocopy or copy people's car designs, but you can, as a designer, carry stuff with you in your head. You know, you can't copy that. And from McLaren, I felt that I was meeting some resistance to things that I wanted to do with the garage, some ideas that I had about putting floor graphics down on the floor around the cars, which now is commonplace. Everybody does it. Red Bull were the first people to do it. And that was at my suggestion. And I had all these things I wanted to do, and I just brought them all over to Red Bull. I've got all these ideas about what I wanted to do with the garage, and graphics, and Red Bull just went, yeah, fine, get on with it. That was a difference. That's a key difference.
Yeah, I think that when you have very empowered people, sorry, I thought my power, I think my power went out. When you have very empowered people, sorry. Wow. Inside of your company, I think that, you know, you foster just a level of momentum that can't easily be slowed down, you know? And I think that, you know, your description of that change is kind of a testament to, you know, how quick people can get through anything. You look at, here's an example. You look at Abu Dhabi 2021. You know, it's, I can make a decision and dig myself out of a hole in a second, or I can freak out about the situation. And I think that, like, all things aside, in that particular circumstance was two totally different kind of leadership cultures inside of a sport reacting in the way that they have, like, brought their people up. And, you know, you saw strategy decisions being made immediately. You saw, you know, pit stops being done immediately. It was not so much of like, why are you doing this? What's happening? The rules are messed up, blah, 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 blah. It was, here are the things in front of us and we're going to react to that. You know, like, again, we go back to Maverick. You don't think you do. And like, I see that so much in Red Bull culture of like responding and like making decisions like immediately. Like, even if it's a bad decision, you've made a decision and it generally works out because you have talented people. On the flip side of that, you can react emotionally to a set of circumstances and be totally blind to the fact that somebody else made a decision and they just leapfrogged you in that situation. I love the way that Red Bull just operates from a business standpoint. And I love talking to people inside of that to just kind of, for me to reiterate that what I see as a fan is the same.
I think one of the best and earliest examples I can remember of that is if you look at Vettel's first championship in 2010 in Abu Dhabi, going into that race, it was between Alonso and Mark Webber. And Vettel was kind of a little bit off the lead. And Ferrari made the mistake of covering off what Mark Webber did. And then consequently, he got dropped into traffic. He got held up. Vettel went on to win the race, won the championship. You know, we rolled the dice. We didn't try and preempt what anybody else was doing. It was Ferrari's obsession with closing off Webber meant that Vettel came through and won it. He hadn't been leading the championship at any point that whole year until that last race. And, you know, and he ended up champion because of it, because we stuck to our game plan. We're flexible enough to, and we're fleet of foot enough to be able to make those decisions on the hoof. You only have to look at, you know, the great strategy decisions that they're making this, you know, over the last couple of years. But that's what we did. And I think that's a similar way you could say that we looked at it in Abu Dhabi. You know, I guess if you're chasing, you have less to lose, throw on some tires, see what's going to happen. Give it a go. You know, it's easier to chase than defend your position sometimes. So in that regard, we have the upper hand. So, you know, we didn't have anything to lose. So why not? Why not give it a go?
I have this target list of people for my show. You know, I've got everyone on the paddock that I want to have. Like, I want to have every title from every team on the show. And then I have like the targets. Like the people that, you know, I will probably only be able to communicate with when I attend a race and, you know, go behind the scenes. But I want Hannah Schmidt on this show so badly to talk about decision making, like how you do, because you're looking at a dynamically changing set of circumstances by the tenth of a second. And to be able to like see the future in certain circumstances, I always have, like, if we're going to use our movie references, I always go back to Endgame when Dr. Strange is like, you know, going crazy. And, you know, he's like, I looked at 14 million situations and only one worked, you know, in a couple of seconds. And I feel like that role, that's what they're doing, is they're evaluating an infinite amount of circumstances in a second and making a decision and, you know, living by that decision. And it works out. I love people that make decisions under pressure.
Have you reached out to her? Is she responding?
I don't know how to get a hold of her. There are certain people, Stefan, that are like, they're accessible, you know, but not like, will they respond? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, Anthony Hamilton has like zero registered email addresses. He has no like presence on social media, nothing. Like, there's nothing. Hannah's to me is kind of the same way. So I gotta pick up my game here.
I can send her a Teams next week. So I've done it. It was great.
You got it all figured out. You're
she's,
awesome.
She's the nicest person. She's great. You know, her and Will in strategy are both excellent people. She'd be very good.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just something about this sport and the people within it that just fascinate me. No matter what the role is, it's this like this. The creatives are creative beyond anything. And, you know, the engineers are just as creative, but also highly skilled. And, you know, working around the words of rules. And, you know, and I just like, I really admire that because it helps me professionally to be around that. So I can say, wow, when I'm in a circumstance of having to make a decision, or like in your, like, I need to be creative. I need to create a company event next week, you know, and say like, well, what could we do that would be, you know, creative or appealing to the team where they would get fired up over it. You know, it's great to talk to people like you because you do operate at the highest levels of, in my opinion, business and competition. And I don't care what your role is. You guys are all rock stars. Netflix should do a show about you guys too. And I'm not flattered. Well,
did you see me sneak into the Drive to Survive then when they were doing the Alex album? I was lurking.
Were you?
It's when
I'm going to go back and look.
Thomas Butler was doing the photography in the race bays, and we pretty much had to shoot Alex at exactly the same angle and emulate the lighting conditions of Abu Dhabi, where we'd shot Pierre and Max on the track. And we had to emulate that, and we had to then drop him in to those shots that we'd taken. And I'm lurking on the peripheries. People took screenshots and kept sending it to me going, you're on TV. I didn't have a major part, though. It's more like a cameo.
I have two Drive to Survive guests on my show, you and Dan Ricardo's performance coach. So I think
Michael was probably in it a bit more than me. I think he was probably in it rather more than me. Yeah, that's the way I like it.
Same team. You no track exposure?
Oh, I mean, I go out as and when required. Yeah. I mean, in my time, I've probably been to most of the circuits. I'm going to the Bahrain test for a week in February. I'll be out there because we have a garage to finish building. One of the problems with sea freights leaving when they do is that quite often the first couple of sets you send are not quite finished. So we have want to finish and actually build up out in Bahrain. I've always been very much of the opinion I'm there if I have a role and I have a use there. Generally, people at the track tend to fall into one of two camps, really, don't they? They're either making the car run, or operating the car, or something around the car, or they're looking after partners or guests. And I kind of don't really fit into any of those roles, really. I tend to be there if I've got a specific thing that I need to look at, if there's something new that's making its debut that I've introduced, if there's a meeting going on with somebody that's there and you can't arrange it from anywhere else because of the people who are involved. So I'm always out there if I have a specific thing to do. And so there will be occasions where I do, you know, when I was in charge of all the photography as well, I did Abu Dhabi 2 years in a row because we would use the time immediately before and immediately after the race to capture imagery that we would use for the following year. So, for instance, we would have very secretly next year's race overalls available, and we could then take shots of the drivers in various scenarios that would be ready for next year. They do a lot of modeling for what we call the lifestyle range of clothing as well, which is like fan wear, t-shirts, caps, accessories. We would take them to a cool location and have all that stuff in the bag before Christmas, so it was ready to go for the following year. So I attended that race for a couple of years because there was that stuff to do as well. So In terms of a relationship, obviously work very closely with the sporting director. I have a good relationship with him. A lot of what I do is used by the race team. It's the environment that they work in. It's the pit wall that the guys sit on. It's the back of house garage. It's the way that the team presents itself. So you have to have strong working relationships with the guys who are building this stuff, tearing it down, looking after it, usually feeding back that something's gotten broken or something needs fixing, so it's easier to put together. At the end of the day, at grassroots level, everybody wants something that goes up and down in like an hour so they can get off to the beach or the bar. No one wants to be packing down a garage, in the middle of the night or early the next day. They want it all to go up and down as quickly as possible. So there's all that learning. Effectively, the first one of anything that we do is always the prototype. We don't have the time to make endless prototypes and iterations of things to get it right. The first one out there is the prototype, and then each successive one will be a little bit better, and you'll learn from each one. So by the time they kind of get to be refitted the next time, you can then capture all of those changes and improvements that you've made and hopefully make things a lot easier.
Do the driver personalities or the drivers have any effect on kind of the creative process, or is it the brand? What is the inspiration? I mean, the car livery doesn't change, but for the most part, but like, what is the, like when you go into a new season, like what are you using for that creative process to kind of inspire the following year?
I mean, it's always going to be stuff associated with the brand. In terms of the drivers having an effect, really, a lot of the drivers tend to have their own clothing lines now, don't they? I think Max has got his own shop where he sells stuff that's personal to him. Obviously, they're drivers' helmets. There are constrictions over what logos have to go where. Red Bull has to have a certain presence on it in a certain style. So certain partner logos have to be in certain positions at certain size. Beyond that, they pretty much have free rein to do whatever they want. So that's where they tend to exercise their kind of creativity side of it. In terms of the team wear and what they wear, that's very much dictated by us and the brand. You occasionally have some situations where I don't know if most people traditionally see the driver's underwear, the Nomex fireproof layer that they wear, that you often see the drivers wearing with they have their race suits down and they tie the arms around the waist. I mean, they started off in years gone by as just a plain color. They were all white, kind of a yellowish color, which is as a result of the Nomex. Then people got into branding them as well and starting to put partner logos on because they figured out that, oh, when you wind the overalls down, you're missing that branding exposure now. So we need to get those on there as well. And one of the things that I wanted to do and worked very closely with the manufacturers was to make the underwear blue. And that took a long process to be able to get the dye the right color on the Nomex and not to affect the weight, which is obviously very important, and not to affect its fire retarded qualities as well. So we got that to a state where it was looking very good, all the logos were looking good. But obviously, as you know, if you wear a dark t-shirt out in the sun and you wear a white t-shirt out in the sun, 5 minutes outside in the black or the blue t-shirt, you're going to feel quite a lot hotter than you are if you're wearing a white t-shirt. So there were a few complaints from the drivers initially that I'm so much hotter now. If I go out in the sun in Australia with the dark blue underwear top on, I feel so much hotter. So I think a few conversations were had, and all those arguments have magically disappeared now. You rarely hear anything disparaging now. I think they probably had thought about it a little bit and figured how long are you out in that situation, and how long are you actually in a car with an extra layer of fireproof overall over the top? So you
Yeah, I
sometimes get those
remember.
kind of little tugs of love, tugs of war.
I actually remember a radio message from Valtteri Bottas in 2021, maybe 2020, when they introduced the black car. the black overalls, and you know, and I think they had ended up in the Middle East somewhere, and he's just like, it's so hot. So of course, you know, that was the only time we ever heard that, so he didn't win that argument either. Yeah.
I mean, so, it certainly in my time in F1, the thickness of the race suits now compared to back in the early 2000s, it's night and day. The weight's decreased, the thickness has decreased. There's no loss of performance, or the ability to resist fire is all still there. But the technology, though, they've come down in weight so much. As well, the days of big sewn-on patches have all gone as well. You know, the branding is all incorporated within the graphics now as well. So, you know, that technology as well has come on massively, massively.
How does your role or your group, are you guys over a car livery as well?
We do get involved with that. You would be surprised at the amount of resistance that you get. And I mean, I see it in terms of what we find nowadays is an iconic, you know, it's the Gen Z, or it's the 20-second attention span. There's always a clamoring for, oh, Red Bull have wheeled out the same livery again. Oh, it's so boring. Why don't they do something different? Which is partly why we introduced the test liveries, because we could, just to mix things up a little bit. But with my age group as well, I went through a whole period of from like pretty much 1981 to 1996. McLaren had the same fluoro red and white Marlborough logos every single year on that car because it was a brand. It's what was expected. And at that time, nobody was moaning about the fact that, oh, the McLaren looks the same every year. That's what was expected. That was the brand. Ferrari is red every year because that's what people expect. So certainly the biggest single change that we've had, I think off the top of my head, and I might be wrong here, it was 2014 when we went from the kind of the gloss color, of which that's a good example, mm-hmm. to the mat with yeah. the fluoro logos. That was the biggest single change. And that went through all sorts of hoops. There was resistance to changing it. At the end of the day, I believe a scale model actually got shown to Dietrich Mateschitz, Mr. Red Bull, and he signed it off. He said, yeah, go for it. Go for it. Because at the end of the day, you know, He was the brand in many ways for me. He still is the brand. You know, he set the tone. And if he had the flexibility to say that you can go from how it has been done to this, then that was fine. Nobody could argue with that. And I think it's been an incredibly successful livery. And a lot of that is because we have some very talented guys over in our paint cave mixing formulations of colors. And the colors that they've come up with are remarkable. They're very difficult to maintain because they're not very resistant to UV, which unfortunately is daylight, sunlight. They degrade. Fluoro colors are unstable. That's why they look as good as they do. So we haven't necessarily set ourselves a look that's particularly easy to maintain, but I think the effect is worth it. It's a tricky thing to do. It would be much easier to go back to this, you know, this gloss, but you know, I think we're all the better for it. But all that leads me to is that was such a huge, massive change. I think there's quite a resistance to change from within Red Bull. And I see why, because we've established something that's iconic. It's something that everybody recognizes. If you're changing your livery each year, I mean, I remember when there was a period when Jordan went and became Midland and then became Spyker and then became Force India and then became Racing Point. They seem to be changing their livery almost every year. And you're thinking, you know, what's the brand of this team, what's there for you to grab hold of and instantly recognize. I'm a big believer in, you know, you instantly know an Apple product because of the way that it's designed and the way it's considered. And I think Red Bull should have that same instant flash of recognition. You know, on what we do, it couldn't belong to any other team, the way that we do things as well. We can make life hard for ourselves as well. We don't just buy, you know, an off-the-shelf garage and modify it and put our own paint scheme on it. We design something that's harder to make, but it's also, you know, it's simple. It looks simple, but it's actually harder to make because it's not just flat walls. It's because it has the shapes and forms that people expect now. There's a lot of things that I do in there. People don't notice them, but we're here to sell this. This is why Red Bull Racing exists, is to sell an energy drink. And what is a three-dimensional representation of Red Bull? So the sides of the pit wall, next time you see it on TV, they both have an angle on each end and they're the same angle as on the Red Bull can. Not many people might notice that, but I know it's there. In the garage that's coming, there's a lot of angles now. They're going to feature on cut-off video screens and walls that we're going to introduce in Bahrain. And they all have these features in. And that's the link. That's the link back. That's not forgetting the heritage. That's not forgetting the product. And it's bringing those features in. And that's what I always strive to do as well. It's not things that are necessarily hit you in the face. We're not painting the car in Red Bull can colors, but there's those little features there and there's stories that you can tell around it as well. It's that kind of attention to detail.
People love esports. I had the head of esports for Williams, and that people love that. And we're working on pulling in a race engineer for esports to talk about like how the strategists and engineers strategize for some of the endurance events and stuff like that. Fans love that stuff.
I mean, to be quite honest, I don't claim to know that much about esports. You know, I don't even own a games console. I have done in the past. I've had the PlayStations and stuff, but whether that makes me uniquely positioned to design an esports room, but it's just one of those things where we moved into a new building and it was clearly a thing. And again, you know, what does a Red Bull esports room look like? So, you know, you go out and you look at a few mood boards, you have a look at what's out there. There's a lot of bare brick. There's a lot of chain link fencing. There's a kind of a bit of an industrial look. But that's not really what we wanted. You know, I kind of saw it as more of a spaceship thing. And I think that leads back to when we were groping around for what should the logo be. And I had this idea of, well, all gaming, regardless of what platform it's on, whether it's Xbox, whether it's PlayStation, whether it's on a PC, an Apple, it all comes down to circuits, doesn't it? So it's electronics. Mm. So we use that as a basis, initial basis for that. And then that was a theme that we then ran through into the room as well. Because the space, it wasn't a particularly good space. So we then had to come up with a way of disguising these walls in the easiest possible way that we could. So we came up with this system of kind of prefabricated boxes that literally sat on the wall. And then you could hide the fact that the wall wasn't that perfect by creating this whole new skin. And obviously, you know, being a child of the 80s, I was always quite obsessed by things like Tron and the early computer graphics. So it was like, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could like get red lasers in the floor? So we ended up finding this supplier who could make these red LEDs that we then routed into the floor and we set them off at angles. And the whole thing was kind of quite an organic process, really. I think I remember seeing online about an office that Red Bull had in Amsterdam, and they had the bull, the leaping bull, and it was a feature wall, and it was broken up into segments. And like if you're like watching a film or having a memory of something, and you think, yeah, that's exactly how it was, and then you go back and look at it when you've finished, and it's actually not very much like it at all. You have this imprint of what it looks like, and you think, yeah, we'll do something like that. And it's actually turned out to be very different from how that was. So it sparked off something else. But it, you know, it seems to have gone down pretty well. I got my Star Wars TIE Fighter electric door in there as well. You know, I'm unashamed about quoting my sources. There will be something from Star Wars or Blade Runner in just about everything I do, whether it's overt or implied. There's always something in there. I think it turned out pretty well. I mean, I've seen some what other teams have done, and it looks like a big office space with carpet tiles and a whole bunch of play seats arranged in rows with some kind of trophy cabinets on the walls. And I like to think that we've done something a little bit different from that. You know, it certainly seems to have gone down well, and we had some good reviews and write-ups for it. So again, that's putting a hat on that you may not necessarily, you know, have any experience with, you know. But at the end of the day, design is design, and I think, you know, whatever discipline you're in, you'll always have ideas. You know, we worked on the Red Bull shop downstairs as well for fans. I've never designed a retail space before, and it's just you kind of find your way through it, really, which is probably what most people are doing. Just kind of finding their
What
way
about
through it. It isn't until you've got one of those under your belt that,
the Red Bull Ring? Do you do any of that?
what at the circuit, the Red Bull Ring circuit.
That
That's
just came to me when you said
completely
the Wii
run and
people.
managed by the team in Austria.
It, okay, okay.
Yeah, that's all been done from Austria. I mean, this is this thing. It's like the seed of creativity is right there, you know, in Red Bull as well. It emulates out from the whole brand to begin with. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with what Red Bull HQ looks like by the lake in Fushël. There's not a single sign on it anywhere that says Red Bull. It looks like two volcanoes coming out of an artificial lake, with some very strange sculptural features in this garden, which is supposed to like harness energy. And it's got, I think, the biggest bronze sculpture in Europe of this herd of rampaging bulls coming out through the glass of the atrium and into the lake. But there's not a single sign anywhere on the reception desk, on the road in, that says Red Bull. Not a single thing. Not a thing. So if that's the HQ your team's operating out of, there's a pretty creative mindset, you know, right from the beginning. And certainly all the things that they touch as well. And so I wouldn't say there's a pressure there, but you just think, well, we're going to compete with that as well. You know, in terms of marketing exposure, we're probably the biggest thing that Red Bull does globally in terms of exposure. You know, their continued involvement with us proves that they're getting bang for their buck. And in terms of marketing exposure, with success, you know, comes fans, comes eyes on the product. That's why I still see more, you know, I've got two daughters, 16 and 18, and them and their peer group, you still see more of them with Red Bull than you do with other energy drinks that I won't mention here. So the brand is, it's, you know, it's got something that connects. It's got something that connects.
Sorry, I have to just I've actually written a lot about that other energy drinks company. Just I think the whole situation is hilarious,
Oh,
but
okay. Well,
I'll leave it alone. I'll
you
leave it
know,
alone.
it's wherever you get success, you're always going to get other people who come and, you know, try and emulate the model, aren't you? It's the way it goes.
Yeah, I think they work too hard on the brand and not on anything else, but be careful before I get sued. What, how do you benchmark success? So as a creative, like obviously you have massive name recognition and like, you know, I'm a marketing guy. Like I recognize talent, I recognize good work. Like how do you as a Formula One team and as a leader inside of Red Bull, like how do you benchmark success for creative?
That's a tricky one. I mean, I'm always my own fiercest critic, so I've got to please myself, and probably in the way that Adrian Newey and the design team will never be satisfied with the race car, and it's always a work in progress. It's never finished. I view that with a lot of my projects as well. But generally, if it's well received, and generally good noises are made about it within the team, that's who you've got to satisfy. They're your client. They've got to be happy about that. Plus, I've been embedded in this team and within Red Bull and understanding Red Bull for 17 years now. And it does, you can't help but absorb, what it is, what makes the brand work. And I think one of the strengths of Red Bull that certainly in my time wasn't there at McLaren is that there's no set way of doing things at Red Bull. The brand can mean lots of different things. It can reach in a lot of different ways, and I think that there's certain things. It does it look cool? Fundamentally, does it work for the team? Is it practical? Is it a good place for the guys to work, build the car, use pit stop, make strategic decisions, look good on the camera, when it sweeps across the pit wall? There's all of those things. So, and there's for me, benchmarking success though is and I'm sure I'll do it at the test in a few weeks' time, is that wander up and down and just taking a peek as much as you can before you get shooed away because you're wearing team kit, and thinking, is our stuff better than theirs? Does it look cooler than theirs? Is our garage better lit than theirs? Because one of the big issues was always that there wasn't enough lighting in there, and you had the camera sweep from outside in the pit lane into the garage, and you go from bright and it would be this dark hole. So we try to up all the light levels massively, so it's much brighter to be inside, to work in. Light levels are much more consistent for building the car, better for the cameras. So benchmarking success really is that the team's pleased. What doesn't really drive what I do, and I know that it drives a lot of things that teams have to do now, is kind of like fan approval, and it's not fan led. It's you would hope that by doing stuff that works and you think it works for the team and looks good, then by nature, people should come to it. You do an iPhone and it just works better than any phone did before it, and people didn't realize that they needed an iPad or an iPhone before Apple did them. So by doing, by doing stuff that looks different, we could have done straight sides on the pit wall, but I wanted them to be curved outwards so it looked like the Red Bull can, and it gives it a different kind of stance when you see it on the TV as well. It's not rigid and upright. It's got a little bit of a presence and a little bit of attitude to it. And it was harder to make, and it was harder to make strong. It was made it more complicated to do. And there was a lot of debate. I wanted it to be steeper, then it got shallower, and you end up compromise in the middle. But it's not doing things that other people do. And because of those things, hopefully people will be drawn to it, and people think, yeah, Red Bull do look cool. Their pit crew helmets don't look like huge motorbike helmets. They've found ones that are quite dynamic and a little bit more streamlined, a little bit more aggressive. They don't just look like a motocross helmet that you bought and put some paint on. So, for me, benchmark success is that if you're generally getting good reactions, you don't have to get a multitude of good reactions, because I'm not in an audience where you do get that kind of thing, but it's setting your own standards and thinking, the core people that you're around, if they all give you the thumbs up over this stuff, you've cracked it. I've got some colleagues who have left over the years, so I still keep in touch with some of them are, quite far-flung parts of the world now, who still work for Red Bull. And I usually kind of send them something and think, do you think I'll crack this? What do you think? Because they're coming at it from completely cold. They've had experience of the team, but they're not still within it. And if I get a good reaction from them, it gives you that distance to be able to think, yeah, I think we've done a good job here. I think we're on a good job. Obviously, I'm pretty nervous to see how the new uplifted garage is going to look in a few weeks' time. It's going to be a bit nerve-wracking.
Now we're all going to be paying attention because you
Well,
mentioned it.
nothing travels as no. So one thing I've learned about F1 is that nothing travels as fast as bad news in F1. You know very quickly if something's broken or something's not quite right. If you don't hear anything, it tends to mean it's okay. It's gone well.
What is in your long career in Formula One, what's been your pinch me moment?
There's been a couple. I think one of the things that happened when I'd only been at McLaren for maybe 6 weeks or so, we were in they were in the stages of choosing a furniture contractor for the McLaren Technology Center, and they picked a company who were in Italy, and because I was doing some details on it, I got a phone call from Ron's PA, and she said, Ron's going to Italy. We're going to go and review some furniture over there. Can you come on Thursday, please? I'm like, yeah, okay, that's fine. What do I need to do? She goes, oh, you just present yourself at the TAG Aviation Terminal at Farnborough Airport at like 7 in the morning. So I'm like, fine, okay. And so I kind of turned up, and there's obviously a private aviation terminal there. And then we got proceeded to get the couple of us got whisked onto Ron's private jet, his Gulfstream that was sitting on the tarmac. You get on, you have to take your shoes off, and then you wade through the thickest, deepest pile carpet known to man in your bare feet, and you sit in these huge, very tastefully decorated leather armchairs, and they start the engines up. Ron's Merc screams up on the tarmac to the bottom of the stairs, and he just gets up. Comes on board, they shut the door and off you go. So that was pretty crazy to be going on Ron with Ron sitting opposite you in the opposite chair, flying to Italy, Treviso in Italy for 2 hours after I'd been there for 6 weeks. I can remember being so terrified I didn't order the cooked breakfast from the steward because I was petrified that I might spill something. It wouldn't do well to get a grease spot on that very expensive carpet. On that very expensive table. So I think I had some yogurt, which I ate about an inch under my nose. That was quite an interesting experience. The meeting went very well. It was great. It was really good day. And I think obviously for me, winning the first world championship with Red Bull, but even greater than that was probably getting our first win in 2009 in China. A 1-2 in the wet. Because for the first 3 years I was at Red Bull, we got three podiums in 3 years, one podium per year. So this was a team that, were kind of average midfield at best, and then all of a sudden we won a race. And I can remember it very clearly because due to the time difference with China, it was pretty early in the morning in the UK. And I'd been at a party the night before, and I was feeling a little bit worse for wear, but I still insisted on getting up and watching it anyway. And just watching us absolutely rinse it in the rain and finish 1-2, you just can't describe that. It was absolutely crazy. The phone was going, quite a lot of people proceeded to then take up exactly where they'd left off the night before and all went out drinking again on a Sunday because it was just. To have gone from that to be there on the moment where we turned into race winners was absolutely incredible.
It's a beautiful, it's a beautiful story. I loved watching Vettel come out of Toro Rosso with his win in Monza, and then, coming to Red Bull shortly thereafter to the mothership, and just, I don't know, it just, it was, while it was a dominant period of time, it was still a war. With the last, I don't know, call it the Mercedes domination, that was domination. That was, probably up until, the last couple of years when you guys, started to spread your wings out. But man, I think people forget how close those four seasons were to second place.
We never had it easy. It never felt easy. No, it really didn't.
I think that's a true testament to Vettel's talent. I wish we could have seen some of that at Ferrari and Aston Martin as well. But I just, again, I'm a fan of competition, and when there's an all out neck and neck war, I'm glued. I can't get away from fierce competition like that. I love it.
I think some of that comes back into what I said about having the right people in the right place, maybe at the right time. I think Seb was always very comfortable in Red Bull, and it was a team that worked well for him. And I can understand his reasons for leaving, because he had ambitions. Danny Ric was coming up, and he was nipping at his heels. He got the opportunity to drive for Ferrari, who would say no. Right. But I think also with Danny Ric having come back to Red Bull now, I think we'll probably see the better of him again now. I really do. I think he'll, mentally, I think, he'll be on it. I think he'll be good. I think he'll be very strong in the sim. I think if he gets a chance, he'll want to be in that car. I think it just works for him. It's an atmosphere. But I mean, as we all know, historically, some drivers really struggle at Red Bull. It's where we went through so many kind of second drivers, if you will, in a period of time, because it doesn't work for everybody. But I think for Seb, it really did. It really worked for him. I think for Daniel, it really worked for him as well. For Max, it's clearly really working.
It should just be a permanent contract. Like, whenever he's done, it's done. Like, that's basically what it should be. But I'm a huge Ricardo fan, because I think there's brand personality synergy between him and Red Bull. And if I'm being honest, like, the writing that I've done on Formula One has been about the business of Formula One. If I was in these roles, or if I was in the decision seat, what would I do commercially? And he's so good for the sport commercially. It's a shame to see him on the sidelines. I'd love to see him in a driver's seat in 2024 with Red Bull. But
nice.
Sensitive topic. But I would say that if there's anywhere that he could have gone, even above and beyond a top team race seat, I don't think that he would have the recovery that he needs right now that he's going to get with Red Bull. Because yeah. I just think that it's like going back home. You just go back home. It works. It makes sense. You can be yourself. You don't have to prove anything. We know it works because it's worked before. You don't forget how to drive a car, but you can certainly burn out and anywhere. And it's going to be really neat to watch him go about Max. I love Max's personality. Like, there is no emotion. He's just very frank. And I like that. Like, I will tell you, like, off camera, if we continue to talk, like, I don't do superficial. I like be like, yeah, Ryan, your podcast sucks. Or, man, it's really cool. We need to tell, I need to hear that stuff, And I appreciate friends that do that to me, which is, drives me forward. It helps me grow. And I think that's the kind of personality we need in motorsports, is no BS.
Max is Max, he just gets on with it. That's what he does.
Yeah.
There's no persona there. It's not like the camera switch off, Of course, the jokes are dirtier and the language is a bit saltier, but it's probably like that with everybody.
Yep.
But Max is Max. He just has a single-minded focus, on what he wants to do. He's got a really good team management around him as well, and people, team Max. that are with him, you know, and all the ingredients are there for him, and you know he's delivering. So
What getting into the sport, coming from the outside world, not a motorsports fan, what has caught you off guard about, or what didn't you expect is probably a better way to ask that question, coming into Formula One?
Taking my career as a whole, despite what people might think, that it's not an unlimited pool of money, particularly not nowadays. I mean, there is a lot of money around the sport, but quite often you're limited in the ways that you can spend it. I mean, not everything that I do is marketing related as such. Obviously, certain elements of it are very much so, which is outside of that, but there's cost cap restrictions. You know, we've been looking at some stuff today and some changes that I want to make. The cold hard figures of them are quite high, and you've got to think, well, what are we going to get out of this for, you know, what's the benefits of spending that money? So you do have to look at things more than you thought you might do. And one of the things that struck me, I mean, not so much nowadays, but at grassroots level, some elements, some people are always very resistant to change. I mean, two of the garage changes that I made almost came to physical blows, actually, with some people over it, because they don't want it to change. They view that what you're bringing in from the outside at first, it's going to take longer to put up than what we do at the moment. Well, yeah, maybe initially, until you find your way with it and you learn it. And by the time you've been working on it for a few races, it will be as quick, if not quicker. But there is a lot of resistance to change and to new things. You know, with the car and changes like that, because it's driven by engineering, it's driven by performance, people don't really question it because that's ultimately what you're there for. But if you're designing a new pit wall, if you're designing a new garage, you are designing a new bannering system that goes outside the back of the garage and it's selling a brand and it's selling a look, as you know, as well as some efficiencies. If it takes longer to put up than the old one, that doesn't go down very well at all. You know, there you will meet some resistance. It's
Look,
it you know it's, yeah it,
I'm
you know
in.
it's it, yeah it's a grassroots. That surprised me, because going into it, I would have thought, you know, F1's at the forefront of everything. People will just do whatever, and you know, whenever it's required. But it's not like that. At the end of the day, you're still dealing with a sport of humans, and you get some humans who are, you know, very progressive, and you get some who are less so and a little bit more resistant to change. So that did surprise me, but maybe in retrospect, I shouldn't have been so surprised. You know, so because you go in and go, guys, this is going to be the best thing you've ever seen. This is going to be fantastic. It's going to look awesome. You know, we're going to get so much exposure from this. Like, looks all right. And like, how long is that going to take to put up? Like, okay, you know, not everybody is necessarily going to share your utopian vision of this stuff. You know, that's, and you can't understand why can you not see what I can see? You know, come on, everybody get with it. That's probably the biggest surprise.
There's a book, what is it, Who Changed the Cheese, or Who Changed My Cheese, or something. It's been so long since I read that, but you know, I'm in technology and software, and you know, change is hard. You know, you go into a company that wants to solve problems, and they want to be better and more efficient, and you know, transform their business digitally, and you know, it's amazing how much they want something but not really. You know, so I know exactly what you're talking about. I get that on a whole new level. So to wrap it up, I want to respect your time. It's the evening where you are. What advice do you have for young people? People get overwhelmed and kind of they feel like Formula One is this big, intimidating machine. It's like Hollywood. It's too hard to get into, you know, and they kind of give up before they ever start. What advice do you have for young people that want to jump into Formula One?
Be prepared to give it your all. I mean, I know Historically, it's been the F1 was called the Piranha Club. I think that might have been Ron actually called it that. And at some levels, that's still true. You know, it can be a little bit dog eat dog, but it's not impossible to get into. From my perspective, doing what I do, I'm glad F1 wasn't my first job out of uni because I don't think I would have been ready for it. I had been working for about 5 years before I got a job at McLaren. So I already had some grounding and some understanding of what things involved. Obviously, you know, with some roles, you get apprenticeships where they kind of teach you from the ground up of how to do things. From my perspective, I'm glad it wasn't what I came to cold out of uni because, yeah, I wouldn't have been prepared to it. But the jobs are there at the end of the day, you know, the goodwill out. If you're good at what you do and you're passionate about what you do, you know, I don't know when this is going to go out. So, but to give it a bit of a plug, there are three creative roles that are live on the web at the moment to work with my friend and colleague Greg in the graphics and brand department. You know, we are recruiting, we are looking for people. There's a lot of stuff going on, there's a lot of growth going on. There's a lot of, you know, stuff going on around the sport. And, you know, if you're good at what you do and you're passionate about it, you know, you might work long hours. You know, F1 is the only job that I've done an all-nighter in since I left uni. You know, I went through several others. I haven't done one in recent years, fortunately, you know, but I have been there at 5 a.m. closing the door on a crate as they're waiting to collect it in the loading yard to go off to a race. Not having slept very much for the past 2 days, you know, so there can be those elements of it. But you know, if you've got some belief in it, and you're good at what you do, I mean, yeah, the competition is fierce, you know. But you know, if you're good at what you do, and you see a job advertised, that's all I did. You know, I simply applied for a job ad, went for an interview, did a project, had a second interview, and got hired. And I wouldn't say that I was particularly distinguished in my degree year at uni. You know, I've got friends who are in very good positions at automotive manufacturers in design. My career went in a different way. You know, I'm very happy with the way that it went. But you know, if you apply yourself and you know you've got a feel that you want to do it and you see a job advertised, then go for it. You have absolutely nothing to lose. Now you might end up working with some crazy people, but they're the best ones.
What is it? I was watching a movie with my son last night, and I think the quote that's what we're gonna title this thing is like movie quotes or something. But it was, what was it? It was like, live a life of adventure, and you'll have adventurous stories to tell, or something like. I just completely butchered an amazing quote, but I think, you know, with that pressure and with that, you know, if it's coupled with passion and determination and some resilience, I think that you can have just wild stories. I just, some of the stories that I hear from guests, just like after the recording, like when we're done and everybody's comfortable and relaxed, and you know, it's just like, wow, you know, we need to have you come back on and just tell stories. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go.
I was going to say, I've got some bad ones. I've got some bad ones.
Well, we haven't gotten into the any intellectual property yet, so let's stop there. And with the I don't want to get in trouble with your comms team. Or
Yeah,
you.
I could give you a whole list of races where it's a very bad idea to get drunk and find yourself not knowing where your hotel is and relying on a local taxi driver. There's a list of places that it's a very, very bad idea to do that. And there's a list of places where it's probably okay to do that. Suffice to say, I've done the bad ones. I know all the bad ones.
It happens. It
Yeah, of
happens.
course.
It could happen sober too. I had the chief of staff for Williams on the show, and he was telling me his first time to Brazil. I think he got off the flight. He wasn't with anybody. He was by himself and got a rental car and ended up in a bad part of town. And Luckily, he made it to the hotel and was safe and sound, but
Yeah, that Brazil can be a bit dicey. Yeah.
I've never been. That's my 2024 goal is to start going to some flyaway races and check them
Very
out.
cool.
So, Stefan, seriously.
I'm getting the watch tap from my wife now.
My phone's
I
still.
hope I've given you enough information, and
You
it's
have,
edited into some kind of shape. And it won't be tonight because I'm going to have some dinner and sort my evening out. But next week, I can send you over a bunch of images, and then you can see if you can make use of them at strategic points, just to illustrate some of the stuff we've spoken about.
Oh, I will. I will for sure.
Okay.
I every guest I ever have on, it's never a one and done conversation. I feel like I'm emailing guests on a regular basis and getting emails and now texts. So, it's just the podcast has created some really cool kind of quasi friendships, just encouraging people and connecting people and helping you find designers and whatever I can do to help and have fun, I'm happy to do it. Helping people find jobs. I wouldn't be the first time. Stefan, seriously, thank you for coming on. Thank you for telling your story. And you are always welcome on. You've got just the right personality for this.
Well, that's good.
You should do more.
Excellent. Cool. Hope you enjoyed
I did. I did. It was
it.
awesome.